Beauty, we know, has a perennial appeal. In a certain sense, it doesn't require further explanation as to why we love it. Beauty leaps out of the otherwise neutral fabric of reality. It brings a kind of complexity to what can seem otherwise monochromatic. Roger Scruton, an English public intellectual, writes, "Beauty can be consoling, disturbing, sacred, profane. It can be exhilarating, appealing, inspiring, chilling. It can affect us in an unlimited variety of ways. Yet, it is never viewed with indifference. Beauty demands to be noticed. It speaks to us directly like the voice of an intimate friend. If there are people who are indifferent to beauty, then it is surely because they do not perceive it." Now, on this, we can agree. But beyond this, there is little agreement to be had. Beauty, and the discussion of beauty, or kind of aesthetics more broadly, is vexed with a lot of problems, a lot of interminable disputes. So can beauty, for one, be objectively described? Is it a mere matter of taste? Is beauty just in the eye of the beholder? Now, I think that most everyone, excluding perhaps professional philosophers, would agree that some things are more beautiful than others. Right? We all have a kind of intuitive sense, or a common sense, that there is a spectrum, some things being more so, some things being less so. So we're going to operate on that. A kind of good way of proceeding in Thomistic philosophy or theology is just to admit the evidence of the senses. We don't have to kind of leap an epistemological boundary or chasm. We can just say, you know, yes, and then let's think about it. Let's think about it well. Let's think about it in a way that corresponds to reality. So I'm not going to do a lot of those fundamental things, but what I am going to do is just, premised on the fact that we can describe or recognize a difference among beautiful things, how can we kind of give a taxonomy or give a systematization that is coherent and that is compelling and ultimately that is true? Because only the truth has grace. Only the truth saves. So we'll begin then with just a kind of brief philosophy of beauty. It's common in the Aristotelian tradition to kind of carve up reality into distinct things, okay? So perhaps you've heard of this notion of an exhaustive dialectic. If not, I'm about to describe it. So the idea is that reality is one, in a sense that it's united, or that it's comprehensible to some, at least to God. And that we can make distinctions and kind of sort out reality so as to describe everything on offer. So one of the ways that Aristotle does that is by describing categories of being. He says there are two principal ways in which things are. They're either substances or they're accidents. A substance just being a thing to which it pertains to subsist, right? It has a kind of coherence. It has a kind of unity. It's the kind of thing that we would predicate other things of, right? So it's bedrock. It's foundation. And then accidents, just those things that befall, those things that happen to a substance. So these would be the kind of things that qualify a substance. So to be real concrete, like a substance would be like a cat or a tree or like a human being, right? It has a unity, it has a kind of coherence, and then there are things that we can say about that which are accidents, all right? So like this tree is green or this cat is lithe or agile, etc. And so substance being the first category, and then these being nine different kinds of accidents. So that was one way that Aristotle sought to kind of divide up reality as a way of categorizing it. Then he observes, there are certain things that overarch all of reality, certain things that we can see present in all of these different categories. They transcend the categories. These we call transcendentals. So that's all that we really mean by transcendental. It sounds like a kind of numinous or mystical word, but really all that we're saying is that it's something that's present in all of the categories. So that is to say, whenever you have reality, whenever you have something out there that is, we can observe of it these transcendental characteristics. All right. So transcendentals are common to every being in general. Okay? And we can list them here. This is a kind of agreed upon canon. There's some dispute, but we're not going to enter into this. So being, one, true, good, and beauty, and then the Latin words there that St. Thomas would use in his descriptions. All right? So whatever is, is. All right? Whatever is also one. Okay? That is to say, it has a unity to it. It's undivided from a certain vantage. Also, whatever is true. And here, we mean that it has a kind of relation to an intellect. So St. Thomas has this twofold understanding of truth. He says a thing is true to the extent that it reflects God's notion of it, you know, so it reflects the divine idea. But then our minds are true to the extent that they reflect the reality. Okay? So what we're talking about in this sense is the more fundamental, the more basic sense. A thing is true insofar it has being. That is to say, it issues from an intellect. And we're going to talk about this a lot. And then good. So this means that it's desirable, right? It's addressed to an appetite. So because I can make sense of it, or because I can think it, I am thereby attracted to it, drawn to it. And then, what's sometimes included and sometimes not is beauty. And that will constitute the bulk of our inquiry. Okay? So, beauty is most closely related to goodness. All right? Some people would describe it as a kind of preponderant goodness, a super added goodness, a kind of resplendent goodness. Okay? Now, beauty is hard to describe, like lexically or vocabulary-wise, but it's also hard to distinguish in what way it is more than good. Okay? Because you can see a good person, like, say, Mother Teresa, for instance, St. Teresa of Calcutta, and it's her moral goodness which convicts you of her beauty. It's almost like her beauty is a kind of transparency to the moral goodness. So we find that these are really closely associated. So other ways that we might want to describe beauty would be like a kind of excellence or eminence, even a magnificence. We would want to incorporate this notion of moral goodness or honor or nobility. And St. Thomas will sometimes use the word nobility almost interchangeably with beauty. Limited context, but they are present. Okay? So, here, just one kind of like distinction among true good and beautiful, and I think this is really helpful as a way of sorting our thoughts. So, with respect to truth, the movement is from the thing to our mind. Okay? So, we kind of assimilate things when we cognize them or when we think them. Okay? So, what exists out there has a formal integrity. It is this kind of thing, right? But we, as thinking human beings, have access to that. And then what it is takes up a kind of life in our thoughts, a life in our mind, all right, that gives us access to that reality in a deeper, richer way, okay? So again, concrete example. Here we go. So I see a tree, and I start kind of collating my sense experience. Let's say I'm in Tucson, Arizona, and it's just that time of the year when flowering fruit trees begin to smell absolutely delicious, you know? It's like almost Hawaiian in its allure. And so like the first thing that draws me is the smell. It's like it's like sweet but crisp. It's like, ugh, devastating, right? And then I'm drawn, and then I realize that they have these kind of like leafy fronds, and then they have this thick trunk with a kind of skin bark toughness to them. And then, you know, I begin to kind of sort out all of my different sense experiences of them. I collate those to form an image of what it is to be a tree. But then from that, I can abstract. So I can draw away from, which is all that abstract means. I can kind of set aside what's particular to this one tree, or what's particular to the matter of this one tree, to formulate a notion of what it is to be tree. And then with that thought, I re-engage with all trees and make judgments about them. Like, this is a more or less excellent tree. This tree smells great. This tree does not. Okay? So, with truth, the movement is from the thing to my mind. Right? It's kind of assimilative. Okay. Now, we want to distinguish that movement from the movement towards things that are good. Okay? So, I would describe this movement, rather than being assimilative, it's ecstatic. So, ecstasy, meaning like to stand out of. We go out towards good things. We are drawn by them. We are enticed. We are allured. We are kind of carried, almost, onto the horizon of our homing. So, in the case of the good thing, I recognize it as fitting for me by a kind of apprehension, and then I am drawn out, all right? I want to move towards that thing to have an experience of it, a richer, more profound, more perfect experience of it. Now, I would submit to you that our movement with respect to the beautiful has both dimensions at work, okay? And this is going to be kind of like a working theory, that what it means to be beautiful is a kind of combination of what it means to be true and what it means to be good, okay? So the word that's often used in Greek, so these are like the Latin terms that St. Thomas uses, but in a lot of this he's using an earlier tradition which would have operated in Greek, and the word that's used often in this sense is kalon, okay? Which comes from the Greek word kaleo, which means to call. So just think about that. Our sense of beauty has at its root this sense of call, a sense of invitation, almost like a sense of vocation, all right? And you can use that in a broad sense. Pseudo-Dionysius, who's dated to around the 5th century, a Syriac monk, he often repeats this phrase, to kalon kale, the beautiful calls, the beautiful invites. All right? So there's this kind of twofold movement. The beautiful goes out so as to draw in. And I think we can liken it to the movement of lovers. Lovers want to possess and be possessed. In the language of chaste lovers, they speak in terms of like self-donation. They want to be holy unto the other. A man finds himself in a, you know, gift of himself. But when you hear it in the kind of in the language of unchaste lovers, they want to devour each other. They want to consume each other. They want to be dissolved into each other. Right? But in both, there's the sense of to possess and be possessed. This, I think, is at the heart of what it is to be beautiful. Okay, so having made this summary journey through the transcendentals, then let's just talk a little bit more specifically about beauty and its constituent parts, if we can speak that way. So it's fascinating. St. Thomas Aquinas doesn't have, strictly speaking, a definition, right? He doesn't have a definition of what it is to be beautiful. He has a kind of description of what beauty does to you, which I love. It's almost, it's phenomenological. He's saying, like, this is how it's experienced. So it's sometimes quoted one way, sometimes quoted another. The way it appears most conspicuously in his works is pulchra dicuntur quae visa placent. Pulchra, we call those things beautiful. Pulchra dicuntur, we call those things beautiful which, when seen, please. So we reckon them, or recognize them, by virtue of the fact that they cause us a kind of delight. But that doesn't yet get at what they are in themselves. And so we're going to move from delight to what's at the heart of it, or what's at the source of it. Jacques Maritain writes, "Beauty is a vision, an intuitive knowledge, and a delight in knowing. Not the delight peculiar to the act of knowing, but a delight which superabounds and overflows from this act because of the object known." All right? So, it's classic to describe three properties of a beautiful thing. This antedates St. Thomas, but he takes it up in his own thought. So he speaks of it as having integrity, proportion, and clarity. These are kind of formal constituent parts of what it is to be beautiful. So integrity. By saying that a beautiful thing must be integral or have integrity, wholeness, we mean to say that it must not be deficient in what it needs to be most itself. It's a kind of fullness of being. Okay? Next. Proportion. This also comes across as consonant sometimes. Consonantia is a word that he also uses in this regard. In saying this, we mean that its dimensions should suitably correspond to other physical objects as well as to a metaphysical ideal or an end. So like we came into the business room, or excuse me, the business center from this entrance, and as you come up to that family, which is the building block of economy, we are told, you're struck by the fact that those mother and father are a bit too tall. Right? You're like, ah. Right? And that causes you like a little bit of discomfort or disquietude. You're like, this is not especially domestic. It's kind of like being lost in an ent forest. You know, it's like, you're more so cowed by fear of them than you are invited into their community, right? So like, to be beautiful, it has to be proportionate, right? Another way of saying, a kind of like rough, easy way of saying this would be like symmetrical. So if you see a tree, you're like, that's a beautiful tree. And then you see it the next day, after one of its large limbs has been shorn off by a lightning strike. You're like, would that that had not happened. You know, it's less so a beautiful tree for having lost its symmetry. And then the third part, and this is most mysterious, is clarity, sometimes rendered as radiance. So that the beautiful thing should clearly radiate intelligibility. It should clearly radiate intelligibility. That is to say, the logic of its inner being. And it should impress this knowledge of itself on the mind of the perceiver. Which is to say that our intellect is pleased in light and in intelligibility. A rough way of describing this is that we recognize at the heart of something beautiful an intelligence. We have a kind of sense, whether it be ill or well-formed, that this is from an intelligence and to an intelligence. Right? It's something that was conceived, planned, fearfully and wonderfully made, and that it has been given to us. You know? Okay. So that's our first point, the philosophy of beauty. Our next point is to talk about, to kind of tease out some of these insights, and then to reason upon them. So I have three sections. The first is beauty is embodied and intelligent. The second is beautiful art and contemplation, to talk about the kind of the goal of making beautiful arts. And then the third is just like a little bit about music, okay? Just a kind of application of some of our insights to bring them home. So first, beauty as embodied and intelligent. I would submit to you that beauty entails the communication of a particular embodied insight. Communication of a particular embodied insight. So beauty often entails an insight or revelation communicated in material shape, material vesture, material form. So the beautiful will always be particular, personal, concrete, all right? And as a result of which, intuitive. All right. So the idea here is that the artist infuses matter with form in order to communicate the presence of something encountered. Slight aside, think about this with respect to novel writing. Okay, the good novelist does not set about first to tell a moral tale. He doesn't set about first for the purpose of advocacy. He doesn't set about first to make a profit. If he's a good artist, he sets about first to communicate something that he has seen, that he has encountered, that he has suffered, something that has changed him, something that has given him an insight, a deeper insight into what it means to be human. And then he transposes that insight into his medium so that you can suffer something of the same. So it's always particular, concrete, contingent, historical, right? To communicate in overly abstract terms undermines the art. So, like, I love G.K. Chesterton, for instance, but I don't think that he's a very good novelist, right? Because what you get are themes with names. It's like themes on stilts, you know? It's just like, it's not insignificant that you can't picture the features of any of his characters, right? Because they don't have features. They're thoughts. They're abstractions. Now, mind you, they are beautiful essays, right? They're filled with paradoxical prose and wild witticisms. But they're not, I don't think they're really novels, all right? And I don't stand in judgment over G.K. Chesterton, okay? I am judged by him. That is a passing observation. Okay, so art is principally concerned with manifestation or presentation. And you'll often hear about the paradox of the paraphrase. So like you take a poem, take a Petrarchan sonnet or a Shakespearean sonnet. You can't say like, yeah, these are like nice enough as far as 14 lines go, but I could basically say the same thing in three. It's like, no, that's not it. Because this is the particular concrete form that insight was meant to be communicated in, right? You can't paraphrase that artistry. This is, again, from Roger Scruton. The insight that art provides is available only in the form in which it is presented. It resides in an immediate experience whose consoling power is that it removes the arbitrariness from the human condition. I love that. I'm just going to read that again and then pass on. The insight that art provides is available only in the form in which it is presented. It resides in an immediate experience whose consoling power is that it removes the arbitrariness from the human condition. You were made concrete, limited, discursive for a reason. And embracing that, entering into that, is part of the story of our unfolding and flourishing. And art is addressed to us precisely as such, which is great. Now, we said that it's the communication of a particular embodied insight. It's associated with both rationality and sensation. So first, rationality. We said that it issues from rationality or intelligence, and it is addressed to an intelligence. And here I'll just quote Gilson and move on to the next point. Etienne Gilson writes, "The presence of the man who made the work of art is always felt in our apprehension of it. This is what imparts to aesthetic experience its intensely human character, the work of art being a channel of communication between one man and other men. Hence, it is essential to the beauty of art that it should bring us into the immediate presence of the artist, who is a man, for art is an eminently human thing." Now, think about this and then extend the logic just a little bit to the sublime. So 19th century romantics, those kind of downstream of like Edmund Burke and Immanuel Kant, are really taken with this notion of sublime, and it's associated with nature in a peculiar way. But you can see how some of these insights translate. Like if you've ever stood at the rim of the Grand Canyon, the only time I went on the North Rim, right, which is less accessible. You go through like a little town called Jacob Lake, and then you drive forever on the Kaibab Plateau, and there's nothing there. And then you just come to a vast chasmic expanse that was scoured out of the ground by like, you know, whatever, the Colorado River. And as you like stand on Point Imperial and you look out into this vast space, the confluence of emotions and thoughts is like almost overwhelming. And I'm not, you know, especially romantic when it comes to these things. I'm not often like, you know, just reduced by the vision of things beautiful. But all of a sudden you're here and you don't know whether to like, you know, like, I don't know, shout or weep or sing or swear or like jump or like try to drink it somehow. You know, it's like you just, it's all like very much personal. It's all very much urgent. It's all very much addressed to you, right? And you sense in that, you know, without like kind of giving a loose argument for the existence of God, but you sense in that something deliberate, something intentional, even though you recognize the fact that geologically it took place over the course of like millions of years. And that doesn't like rob you of the sublimity of the experience, okay? So that's what we're talking about. It's associated with rationality. Also, it is associated with sensation. And here I rely on the thought of one Jacques Maritain. So the recognition of beauty is intuitive. Now, we can be trained to recognize beauty more or less well, right? That's the purpose of art appreciation courses. So when you walk through the you come to Washington, D.C. to visit me, and we go to the National Gallery together, and we walk through the Dutch masters, who are an acquired taste, and you just see a whole school of 11th graders just blazing past Peter Paul Rubens, you know, just like, you know, it's like, but we are like those students with respect to yet greater masters of appreciation. So we need to be trained up in the recognition of beauty, and our senses can be dulled. And yet, the perception of beauty is still intuitive, okay? It's immediate, right? So our minds are discursive, which is to say we go step by step. The way this is often explained in like Plato, Aristotle, St. Thomas Aquinas is, all men are mortal. Socrates is a man. Therefore, Socrates is mortal. So we gain insight to certain things, and then we tease out the implications of those things. So we precise our knowledge, we refine our concepts step by step. We are on the way. St. Thomas says we proceed to our end by many movements, as opposed to the angels who do so by one. So our minds are not, you know, they're not intuitive in the way that like angelic minds are, for instance. But St. Thomas will say, or Maritain will kind of expound on St. Thomas and say, our sense knowledge has something of this intuitiveness, or intuitivity, if that's a word. And that is the kind of bedrock that's required for the perception of the beautiful, for the recognition of this manifestation or presentation. So the recognition of beauty is intuitive. And in our case, the senses serve the intellect, and they take delight in knowing. All right? So St. Thomas will say that the reception or the appreciation of beauty is especially associated with the senses of sight, and of hearing. Why, he says? Because these are maximally cognitive, right? So they form a kind of bridge between the intuitiveness of sense, and then the intellectual apprehension thereof, okay? So what it brings about is a kind of peace and simultaneous delight of both sense and spirit. We can be washed in beauty. We can rest in beauty. We can kind of take a peaceful repose in beauty. So that's the first. Second, beautiful art and contemplation. Here, the whole point of this section is just to say that the purpose of art, or the end for which it is made, the arts of the beautiful, is contemplation. All right? It's made to be contemplated. In order to kind of carry the point, I'd like to draw a little analogy with creation. So think about the act of creation, inasmuch as we are capable of such wild thoughts. All right? So let's interrogate God as to his decision. God, why did you create? Why did you create? And we can think that in his eternity, God enjoyed infinite, perfect, you know, superabundant life. The kind of life that lacked for nothing in the enjoyment of his Trinitarian beatitude. So he didn't create out of need, right? God wasn't repining in restlessness in his heavens with a human-shaped hole in his heart, suffering under the labor of loss until such time as we come to be. Nope. He's doing just great. He's doing just fine. All right? So then why did he create? If he lacks for nothing, why did he create? What motivates this movement? Right? It's a mysterious question. In short, though, we can kind of give approximations or we can draw analogies. Right? I have one friend who, when he asks the question of his students, why did God create? He always supplies the answer. Because he thought we might like it. Right? Because he thought we might like it. Another way of expressing it is to say that God had a secret too good to keep. The secret of his divine love. So God has no standard to which he answers beyond himself. God is his existence, his intellect, his act of knowing, and the object of his act of knowing. God is his will, his willing, and the object of his willing. So God only does for love. God acts for love of himself, not in like this egotistical or solipsistic way, but because there is no other standard. He wills the fullness thereof because he exhausts all of being. So he creates us because he loves. He creates us from goodness as a kind of overflowing of the divine bounty and for goodness so that we could share therein. All right? So when you think about it then, why does God create all of this bewildering variety? Why does he create so many things? God, I suppose, could have tried to express himself in one created thing. But here's the sticking point. There is no one created thing that exhausts all that can be said of God, right? Even if God had done his very best, because God is simple. And again, God exhausts all of being. So he spends creation saying many created words so that in so doing, he can manifest more of himself. He fills creation. He fills every nook and cranny with various testimonies of his generosity, of his goodness. So, in a sense, the variety makes his glory more abundantly known, more richly known. And it's addressed to us. Because in contemplating those many things, we have access to his attributes and to return to him. And in the book of Zechariah, or the book of the prophet Zechariah, it says, "And in heaven his name will be one." So we proceed from that variety to the unity of its divine source. Now, to extend our analogy, I would submit to you that art is a kind of creation. Art is a kind of creation. Music, as a fine art, which is where we're going to go, is ordered principally towards creating something beautiful. It is fundamentally constructive or creative. One author says, "The art is the fruit of a spiritual marriage, uniting the activity of the artist to the passivity of a given matter." So what the artist is doing is creating, fashioning. Jacques Maritain writes, "Artistic creation does not copy God's creation, but continues it. And even as the trace and image of God appear in his creatures, so the human character is impressed upon the work of art, the full, sensitive, and spiritual character, not of the hands only, but of the whole soul. So what we're doing in art, what the artist is doing in art, is a manifestation of a kind of human culture. So just as God in creation manifests his many attributes as a way of inviting us to the contemplation thereof and a return to him, so the artist manifests, you know, through his created medium, something of his own human culture as an invitation to our richer sharing therein. So, art, this is the final for this particular point, art begets contemplation, just to concretize and tease out what I've said. There is a non-discursive or intuitive clarity. There's a kind of wholeness to the experience that we have when encountering things beautiful. The intelligence rejoices without work and without discourse. It is dispensed from its usual labor. So whereas ordinarily we kind of have to plod through steps, we abstract, we judge, we reason, we kind of lather, rinse, repeat. Here, it's just given. Jacques Maritain writes, "Like a stag at the gushing spring, intelligence has nothing to do but drink." Roger Scruton writes, "The world before them suddenly changes character from a thing to be used to a thing to be witnessed." And here again, maybe to draw again an analogy with literature, I think that it's a distinctive capacity of art to transfigure and represent your humanity to you. So we live in a workaday world, and we're like the typical standard for our judgments is efficiency or usefulness, right? Why would we do anything? Because it saves time, or because it's a way of getting a good grade with less effort, or because this, that, and the other thing. But oftentimes, our workaday world is colored by a workaday attitude. But the thing that's beautiful about, for instance, reading a novel, is that it's inutile. It's not useful in the strict sense. Even if you bring to it your own kind of dominative tendencies, like I'm going to master the Western canon, I'm in plan two, and I'm going to know everything there is to know about liberal arts, right? Whatever presuppositions you bring to bear on the fact, there's always an element of freedom, of liberality. There's always a kind of, I don't know, the savor of something bigger, something yet more liberating than you have yet experienced. Okay? So, like a stag before the gushing spring, you have nothing to do but drink. And in so doing, I think your humanity is kind of returned to you as transfigured. Because you have this artist, he portrays something of a human culture in a medium that is concrete, and in that you see something of a possibility of human striving, an aspiration that has lain dormant. I don't know, just like a creativity that you yourself had sensed but never developed. And all of a sudden, your humanity is returned to you, refreshed, restored, renewed. You get on a plane, and instead of just like going to go-go in-flight and just watching whatever nonsense movie and shutting off your brain for 2.25 hours, you like think, right? And you're like, I was made for this, precisely this. To fire on all cylinders, to exercise my capacities, those most distinctive capacities which set me apart from the beasts, namely minds with which to know and hearts with which to love. And this, it is what is most peculiar about me, most dignified. This is a kind of meeting place between me and things transcendent. So then, third and finally, a parting word on music. All right, because I think this is just kind of a helpful application. So what makes music? In short, and this is a kind of reductive vision of the thing, but rhythm, sound, and voice, or lyric. And I think that we can build up a picture that draws from our earlier description of the three constitutive parts of beauty. So we said that it has integrity, it has proportion, and that it has radiance or clarity. And so let's weave those into a vision of what music is. All right, so rhythm. Rhythm is just that kind of base component of nature. So whether it's the rhythm of a rowing beat or of a liturgical procession, embodied life is rhythmic, right? That something kind of carries a beat, it shows that it's vital or that it was made by something vital, all right? And rhythm imparts an initial proportion and integrity to the art form. It gives it a kind of skeleton, all right? And here, it's a kind of thing that's shared with dance, right? So the fact that music causes us to move is a testimony to the fact that this is shared with other elements of human culture. Next, sound. And this is made to include like melody, harmony, counterpoint, any audible sounds produced by instrumentation. This, I would submit to you, instances a higher grade of being. All right? This goes beyond rhythm. It's distinctive of cognitive life, things that think, even animal thoughts, right? So animals have a kind of sense cognition already. Because I think that only animals really generate music in the true sense. If you've ever watched either of the two Planet Earth series, the first one came out, I think, in like 2006, and I was in college, and we spent all the finals week just watching the whole thing. And it's just like a bunch of guys who were especially predisposed to wonder at God's creation. And I remember this one scene where there are great white sharks off the Cape of Good Hope who are like leaping out of the water and just dominating these seals, and they're like doing these tail pumps, and you're just like, oh my gosh. Okay, that's beside the point. But I remember this one part where a guy holed up in a hollowed out log, effectively, for like 45 hours just to catch the mating dances of birds of paradise. And you see this thing, you know, and this like bird opens its wings, and all of a sudden it looks like a large smiley face, and it begins playing out this tune. This doesn't quite do justice to the vision. It begins playing out this tune for the wooing of its lady love, and you're like, this is incredible, you know? Right? So music instances a higher grade of being. I should say sound, instrumentation of a sort. And it imparts a more intelligent proportion and integrity to the art form. All right, so it takes dance and kicks it up an octave, or raises it up a register. Third and finally, lyrics. The voice, the human voice, I submit to you, is the crowning glory of music. This is not to say that classical music, which doesn't have vocal elements, is bad. I'm not saying that. I'm just saying that this is what's most distinctive about the human culture at work in the music that we create and generate. The human voice is the most delicate, expressive, and perfect of musical instruments. St. Thomas has this prima pars, like question 91, where he's talking about the constitution of the human body. And he has these really cool observations. They're like primitive anthropological observations about the constitution of the human body. And he's asking why we are made the way we are made. Like, why are we upright instead of like hunched down? He's like, well, if we were hunched down, then we have to use our tongues for like scrounging around for food, and then they'd have to be thicker, and then we wouldn't be able to speak as well or as delicately. But language is one of the highest instances of reasons that would be unsuited. And he goes on from, he's got like a ton of answers. He's like, it's also fitting that we be upright and provident for the fashioning of like a well-seen future. You're like, yes, that's right. Okay. Also, it permits our hands to be more sensitive. And he thinks that's the most kind of indicative of intelligent senses. So the human voice is the most delicate, expressive, and perfective of musical instruments, or perfect of musical instruments. Here, a kind of rough illustration. In the Second Vatican Council, there is a document produced on the sacred liturgy called Sacro Sanctum Concilium, and it gives a kind of preferencing to instrumentation used in the liturgy. And there's a sense that reed instruments, and here you can think of like the organ, are given preference because they imitate the perfection of our mechanism, because they more closely approximate the human voice. So the standard for inclusion in sacred worship, in liturgical worship, is rationality, is human culture, is our voice. So linguistic capacity gives vent to the highest intelligible world which man participates and expresses, and it imparts a rational cast which is otherwise impossible. You can say things with words that you cannot otherwise say, regardless of how expressive your dance or your music without words is, all right? So here, we're sensing the presence of that addressed from an intelligence to an intelligence. And this, I think, gives clarity and the splendor of form, or it brings to perfection what clarity and splendor of form was present only in potential. Now, this might sound like it doesn't square with our appreciation of modern music, right? Because most music that we hear is not this, right? So like, what has happened, okay? So music, in its highest expression, produces the high delight of the spirit by the presentation of something beautiful. We've said that it's an embodied, an intelligible delight addressed to the person as person. Like tragedy, it is meant to purify the passions by developing within them the order of beauty, by harmonizing them with the intellect, all right? It should make you beautiful. here, a kind of parallel with like how we were originally made, how we came to fall, and how we are redeemed. There was an original order. Our minds were subordinated to God, our lower powers to our higher powers, our bodies to our souls, material creation to us. We found it easy to choose a right, and then we stepped out of that relationship and we lost that very beautiful order. And now the whole drama of the life of grace is to be reconstituted in that beauty through a relationship with Christ, who is most beautiful, and paradoxically so. For there is no vision that is more beautiful than that of the crucifixion, and yet it is most horrible, and yet still it gives expression to a love and obedience at work in the act. So, this is from Maritain. The emotions which it makes present to the soul by sounds and by rhythms are the matter through which it must give us the felt joy of a spiritual form, of a transcendent order, of the radiance of being. So art should appeal to us as a whole person. It should reconstitute us as beautiful listeners, as beautiful contemplators, so as to be like the beautiful Christ. Right? And so emotion should be ordered to rationality, what is distinctive about us. Rationality to the prospect of something transcendent. So, as such, it is not ordered principally to producing pleasure. I submit to you that if art seeks to please, and basely and merely so, that it betrays, and it becomes deceitful. Similarly, its effect is to produce emotion. This is like art in general, or music more specifically. Its effect is to produce emotion, but if it aims at emotion, at affecting the appetites or arousing the passions, it falsifies itself, and thus another element of lie enters into it. So what do I mean by this? Well, sometimes you feel that music is reaching into your emotional states and tinkering with them. And I think a lot of us resent that. Now sometimes, let's say like you're driving to Dallas, you got in the car at 11, you're going to get there at 2:30 in the morning, and you're going to fall asleep unless you like, whatever, eat sunflower seeds, drink an incredible amount of energy drinks, pack a lip, or listen to really good music, right? So you're like, back goes the sunroof, on goes the Coldplay, you're like, induced euphoria, let's go, you know? Or something roughly equivalent thereof, right? So I'm not saying that it's bad that music appeal to emotion, but there are certain contexts in which we feel ourselves being tinkered with. And you can think about this in liturgical settings. Right, I especially love Thaxted, which is by Gustav Holst, part of like the whatever. Okay, but it's used in O God Beyond All Praising, and that for me teeters right on the edge. It's like, are you messing with me, or should I let myself be carried away? Right. So Maritain writes, I refuse to accept an art which contrives to seduce my subconscious. I resist an emotion which the will of a man seeks to impose upon me. What we are aiming for is the high delight of the spirit, from an intelligence to an intelligence, in such a way that it reconstitute us in orderly fashion, because there are things about our nature which are lower, and there are things about our nature which are higher, and they should obtain as such. So, what about modern music? What you have is like, oftentimes like beat, rhythm. It's dance with a kind of patina of sound and lyric, right? And I experience this in a peculiar way, because when I listen to modern music, I can't sleep. Because I often wake up and it's recurring in ways that I did not previously consent to, right? So I associate it with like insomniacal bounce, all right? Oftentimes, it's very unimaginative in its chordal progressions. So you can take four chords and play like 75% of what's on the radio. So mashups are testimony to the fact, right? It's a lot of it's the same, all right? There's also, when you get to like voice, lyric, awkward and vacuous rhyme are just the common currency of modern music. Like, yes, tonight rhymes with tonight. and then you also have a retreat from what is distinctive to the human voice. I'm not against synthesizers. I'm not against auto-tuning. But it's somewhat indicative that, like, there is a movement in that direction. And that we experience a kind of, contrary movement towards Americana, old-time folk. Like, a lot of good things that reclaim what is peculiar about the voice of every man. All right. So I think what you end up with is a reduction of music to base passion, to what is lowest and most animalistic. And then you are left with a kind of atrophied spiritual life, a hyper-sexualized club context, all spoken in the slurred, drunken speech of a failed paramour. It's just like, that's all you got. You know, that's all you got. And I don't stand in judgment to it, because a lot of times I don't think it's aiming to be music. I think it's aiming to be entertainment. And I think that we should receive it and understand it as such. Okay? So that is to contextualize our thoughts. A final word, to speak about heaven. I don't mean to get down on modern music. I don't want to just like be a hater of modern music, right? Sometimes it's delightful to listen to, and especially in certain settings. But I want to rather lift our gaze towards the exalted place of true art and true music, because I think music can signify with its rhythms and its sounds and its voice the movements of the soul, all right? St. Augustine is quoted as having said, to sing is of the lover, right? And Maritain writes, song begins where speech breaks off. Exultatio mentis prorumpens in vocem. The exaltation of the mind breaking forth in voice. And I think by engaging in this as a kind of discipline, right, and a kind of asceticism, and a kind of work, a contemplative work, which requires input energy, but which ultimately pays off, that we are making preparation for heaven. I think we are making preparation for heaven. Gilson writes, thanks to the fine arts, matter enters by anticipation into something like the state of glory promised to it by theologians at the end of time, when it will be thoroughly spiritualized. A universe having no other function than to be beautiful would be a glorious thing indeed. And here, just to leave off with an observation, it is not insignificant that heaven is often spoken of as a place of music, one that is ringed about by angelic choirs in an Empyrean dance, one that is constituted by a perpetual liturgy, not one that leaves us cold or otherwise unengaged, but one that draws forth all of the native potencies of the human spirit and brings them to their height. So what remains for us now is to strengthen our voices. Thank you.